Thanks. So I should mention, this is work with collaboration with Dick and Alon and Shihab and Daniel, and I guess that's everybody here. Hopefully you at some point, Keenan. I changed the order of the talks, and this is a big change from yesterday where everything was, you know, cochlear and stuff like that. And I wanted to talk about some other stuff I'm doing. The talk that was supposed to be today is listening effort, and I'll talk about that tomorrow. And I have less to say about that. That's not really my work. But I think it's a really, 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 really important topic, and I really want to present it here and give it more awareness. But today I wanted to talk about attention, because I think it's a really important problem. Many years ago, I should look up when it was. It's been quite a while. I was at a binaural workshop, and there was lots of people. It was, you know, 3 or 4 times the size of this audience, and it was very informal. And there was a lot of discussion, and you know, they were asking hard questions. I mean, it was a discussion. It's like, you know, it's a group like this. It's very good. And invariably, we'd go for a while, and someone would say, "We can't do that. That's the C word." Where C either meant cortex or cognition. And that was the end of the discussion for these binaural people. I mean, they're very smart, but, you know, they weren't ready to deal with the C word. And over the last, you know, 20 years or so, I've come to realize that we really have to pay attention to cortex, because that's really driving a lot of things we're doing. So those of you that are working in the cochlea and the mechanics and all that stuff, I think you guys are great and amazing. I really love what you're doing. But I've been trying to make a contribution at a higher level, and that's what I want to do today. So the reason we're interested in things like this, as we've talked about, I guess, before, is this, you know, canonical cocktail party problem, where, you know, the woman serving the whatever she's serving is listening to her friends say how wonderful they are, but what she really wants to do is, you know, hear the gossip from the person behind her. And, you know, that's something we can do quite naturally. It's not a big deal. The way that this translates into my world is, you know, how do you deal with open microphones? So I'm an industrial researcher, an applied researcher, and I really want to know, how do we make these machines more useful? And one way of doing that is to understand how people do it and try to understand the expectations people have. So we're not going to try to mimic people, but at least understand their expectations so that our machines can work in that kind of environment. And so, you know, we've got all these microphones that are out there now. You know, I have no idea how many are in this room, at least one per person, or maybe two per person, since everybody has a laptop too. And you know, these things, you know, machines want to do things that are useful for us. So the Google Home, Apple's new device, Amazon Echo, are all waiting for us to tell them what to do. And they have to work in these environments. They have lots of people talking, and they have to know when you're talking to them versus, you know, talking to your buddy and all that kind of stuff. And so understanding how attention and things like that, it's like, you know, fit into our world is really important. And so that's what I'm telling my bosses is why we should be working on auditory processing. And so far I've been reasonably successful. Just to sort of get the lay of the land, I like to think about things intention in terms of these top-down processes where these are being driven by your needs and experiences. So right now, presumably, you're all attending to me because you want to understand what I'm going to say. And there's a lot of stuff like language models and things like that that are innate in your system that you've learned that are providing top-down information to help you understand what I'm saying. And so you think it's very unlikely that I'm going to say the word elephant. And that's your top-down, you know, processes saying, okay, well, the language model says that elephant's not going to show up in a cognition talk until now.
But penguins might.
And so that's a very important part of your perception. And then the other part of it is this bottom-up process where, you know, things like this grab your attention and divert you away from my voice. And so, you know, we loosely call that saliency. And I should note that this is a gigantic simplification. People that work on attention in the psychological world have all sorts of exceptions. But I think conceptually this is the right way of thinking about it.
So the saliency, so to speak, would be something that comes from called simple acoustic cues, as in a loud bang or something. And top down then would reflect higher processing, as in some speech signal that somebody wants attention, but looks there's a continuum between that, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's where the psychologists make a finer distinction. So, you know, this is salient, this pops out. The fact that, you know, someone behind you is talking about where to go for lunch and it's lunchtime, you know, makes your attention go back there is a, you know, a top-down process. You know, some other part of your body is saying, pay attention to the food thing or the sex symbol or whatever else is going on. So I don't want to make a really fine point about it. I mean, there's going to be exceptions. But essentially sailing to things that are driven by surprise, things that are coming from the cochlea and causing your attentional system to change its mind about what it should be doing. And top down is your I'm a strong believer in these kind of, you know, top down, bottom up thing. But it's all wrapped up into a big perceptual loop. And so that's what makes this challenging and interesting and difficult to work with. So, you know, you have a desire to listen to what I'm saying. You've got a recognition system that's listening to my speech and trying to form semantic concepts out of that. And it's all in a loop because, you know I'm talking about perception, and so that's biasing your language model and helping you understand what I'm saying. And so you really just can't separate out the salient events from the desires because it's all a big feedback loop. And this feedback loop extends in multiple levels, and I can't go into the details. I don't know all the details, but I know there's a lot of these different loops involved. And so that's what makes this interesting and challenging, because we just can't say, okay, what's going on here? Because it's part of a big feedback loop. And we can't break the loop because, you know, we don't even understand the loop. So we can't just say, well, what's salient or what's top down? It's all a big mismatch. And so trying to address all these things is really difficult. And so what I want to do is show it in this is my outline for my talk, and I'll adjust as necessary. So please ask questions, and we'll make it all work. So I want to talk a little bit about top-down processing and breaking this loop, and eyes versus ears. I want to spend a lot of time talking about saliency, both what kind of data is used to get at the salient events, and models that people have built to model saliency. And both these are very, I think these are both inadequate, but I want to give you a little bit of the lay of the land. So that's the bottom-up side. And the top-down side, I want to talk about attentional models and some work we've been doing on decoding. So how do you use EEG or ECOG signals to understand what the attentional signal or where you're attending to. And then if we have time, I'll close with at least one application that we've talked about and how this actually, you know, can be turned into some money-making or at least a commercial entity. But again, this is very preliminary and it's just a start. So the visual people have this wonderful, wonderful signal for attention in terms of the eye tracking, or in terms of where your eyes are pointed. In general, your eyes are pointing, and perhaps even your head, is pointing at what you're attending to. And it's a wonderful, wonderful signal. And this is an eye tracking data from a long time ago, where, you know, this image was, you know, flashed in front of a person's eye, you know, face, and this is showing their eye movement, or where their eyes attended to. And, you know, it's very much concentrated on the front of her face, the earlobe, the eyes, you know, the outline of the thing. And so this is the person, you know, sort of scanning it, trying to figure out what's going on, what it means. And actually, what I don't know is how many seconds this represents, but I'm guessing it's probably only a second or so. So you get a lot of information from the eye tracking data, and it's really pretty wonderful. And the eye tracking people have done, the visual computation of visual people have done this wonderful job of building models to explain this data. And so this is the classic model by Laurette Eaton and Christoph Koch 16 years ago, I guess, where they explain the visual attention, top, you know, bottom-up process in terms of these maps that are shown here, that given this image, go through this computational thing, combine the features, and tell the eye where to look. And so I'll explain the detail on the right-hand side, but here's this image. They go through this model. They get this map here where brightness corresponds to where the model thinks that the person's going to attend to. And then they do a winner-take-all and say, okay, well, whatever is the biggest, you know, winner here is the winner, and that's where your eyes go. And this is I hope you can see this. It's kind of a cheap trick, if you will, because they have a dollar sign in the bag here, which, you know, semantically has a lot of importance to a lot of us. And so they're mixing up. So this is a very low-level percent. Huh?
They're mixing their metaphors.
Yes, exactly. So this is a very low-level model of saliency. And it points at this, you know, white bag with, you know, some texture on it. And we all say, oh, of course, because it has a dollar sign on it. That's where we're going to look first. But, you know, I don't want to distract from the, I mean, I want to point that out because it's these two levels, not to say the work is bad.
So what's it?
The saliency, so I mean, there must be, as implicit in all this must be a reward function, some sort of utility function that says, I want to maximize future reward, and if that reward function values money, then that would be salient. If you're a poet or something, and well, maybe if not a poet, you probably need money too, but if you're a botanist or something, you're interested in trees, maybe that gives you more reward.
Yeah.
So, but where in this architecture is the reward function?
Nowhere.
So how does it know that the dollar sign is?
Well, it doesn't have a dollar sign because it has no information about semantics.
I see.
So this is purely a bottom-up model of saliency.
I see. So okay. Okay.
So and I'll talk about closing the loop toward the end of my talk. We have a model of that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the same thing. Like, what is the target function, or what is the training? Was there no training in the network? Like, what does it train on?
I don't remember. I don't remember what this box looked like. It combined features, but their overall goal is to predict eye track data.
Okay.
So the model's goal is just to predict where your eyes are going to look.
Right. Where your eyes look probably has implicit in it. Why we care more about faces and dollar signs is has implicit in it those reward functions.
Right. So that's the colorful version of it, but I like showing this version better because it's a little easier to parse. So this is the model. It was shown on the right-hand side of the previous figure. It combines a whole bunch of stuff. So they've got these three channels, if you will, that are looking at colors, intensity, and orientations in the image. And then they do the center surround, you know, wavelet-like type, to, you know, analysis of things. And they get these feature maps at multiple scales. They combine them and then do some linear combinations, and what comes out is a saliency map. And so this saliency map is what was shown here.
This is also a little funny in that in the real world, fast responses are driven by the superior colliculus. They're very sensitive to movement and the like. Don't care about cortex at all. So
right.
It has another layer to it that they're perhaps leaving out.
So after this work, people started extending it to video and movement. So this is just purely a static image.
This is quite a long time. When those images that you see tracking that head, they would each line, each 2 points is 1 second high. So that's like a second or so.
No.
No, I don't mean it takes 200 milliseconds, but people don't know, 200 milliseconds moving there. Typically, that would be a minute or two or three.
Do you think it's that long?
Oh, yeah. There are lots of saccades.
Yeah, there were lots of saccades. I should go back to the original paper. I haven't thought about that.
I was just responding to the, I agree on the superior colliculus, but this is really much longer time scale.
Well, not this one. This is
so
very.
When you look at the scene to track all the different parts of the scene,
Yeah, it'll take you longer. So this is one of their examples, and I forget which paper this is from. So you have an input image. You're doing the color, the intensity, and the orientation maps. And so color shows up well here. There's some brightness and stuff. Intensity is showing up here, so there's the road. And there's some orientation detecting here, and I'm not sure why it's in the firebox. Maybe the vertical lines, I don't remember.
So in humans and some primates, there's a clear difference between covert and overt attention.
Right.
We're very good at paying attention to where we're not looking. So what I'm talking about now is explicitly overt attention.
Yeah.
But then if we're talking about hearing, does this difference in...
Let's come back to that.
Can you...
I don't know the answer, but let's come back to that in a little bit. Because I have to start with this because this is where the best literature is in the visual world. And I want to talk about the auditory side, where we don't know nearly as much. I'm not even sure we know the answer to your question. But let me come back to that. So this is the kind of results I get. And so this is the first thing that happens is, you know, you get this map. This is the winner. And so the focus of attention goes to here. And then they have this inhibition mechanism. They say, okay, you've looked at this, so let's inhibit it. So they draw a circle around this or something. You know, they zero out that response. And the next response is here. The next biggest response is here. And that was here, it just wasn't as large. And so the focus of attention shifts after, you know, a few milliseconds or 3 milliseconds to here. And then they zero that out, and then it gets to this point, and the next thing you look at is the road.
Along the saccade, it just seems that the saccades sort of go back to where they were looking before at the same point. So I guess this doesn't allow for that.
Correct. Correct. All of this is being driven, at the higher level, all this is being driven by information needs. And so you're looking at this and saying, oh, you know, what's a symbol here? So maybe you go back and look at it because that's what you care about more than what the texture of the road is.
And so it's actually striking in the saccade map how much it looks like trajectories, as though you're laying ABC, ABC, ABC over and over. So it tends to follow the perimeter, but it's continuous. It doesn't often double back.
That's inhibition of return. It's a phenomenon. What you just described. But it's not necessarily relevant to pop out.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's the state of the art. I mean, I shouldn't say that. That was a great first step in the computer vision world. And they've done a lot with it. And because of the eye tracking data, there's been a wealth of data and models that make it really easy for any undergraduate to go out and say, oh, let's try to model visual saliency because in this one case, I found over 24 databases of visual tracking data, saliency data. And so it's really easy for someone to download the data set, apply their model to it, and see what kind of results they get. And it's wonderful. And they've made great progress. They've extended it to video. They've got things that, you know, look for faces too. I mean, the first version was just low features. You can look at faces too. They've extended in all possible directions. There's a very large literature in this space.
How much have people analyzed in terms of what the variability between subjects is? So how similar are these maps across subjects, or do different subjects tend to interface, go to different features, or is it very similar? Do you know?
I haven't seen very much work on that. I have seen people talk about differences with dyslexic folks. And so with dyslexic folks, you'll put a movie up and watch where the eye tracking goes, and they don't follow the faces like normal people do. So I know at that level. But in terms of at the level of ED, whether there is a model of, you know, that, I don't know. And then, you know, what's the equivalent for the ears, the auditory system? You know, this is an old, I think this is one of Dick's pictures, or Dick found this originally. You know, with these little artificial ears that they could use to locate airplanes better because they had better, you know, binaural sensitivity, I guess. And it's not clear what signal we should be looking at all. So I wish we had this. I would love to get more data, and I guess that's part of the reason I'm giving this kind of talk is because I want to get people interested in collecting this kind of data, at least talking about the issues. Because if we had these kind of databases, I think it'd be really amazing to have a bunch of people attacking the problem. You know, it's really been amazing to see what these people have done, given these big databases. So I want to talk a little bit about salient sounds. And what makes a sound salient, and things like that. I should give Munya credit. Munya and her student Merve, put together this really wonderful paper. I guess it was earlier this year. Well, they did it last year. I think it got published this year. And I put this up on the wiki. But this is a really great overview of all the different kinds of models and data and stuff like that that's out there. And I want to summarize some of it. So there's lots of ways of presenting this, and I think this time I'm going to present in terms of what sounds are available and then what models are happening. But it turns out that all the sounds are directly tied to a model, because you know someone gets this itch and says, I want to model this, and so they create a sound database that shows those effects, and then they model it. And so this was the very first case. Kaiser, whose name I can't think of, what's his first name?
Christoph,
thank you. And I wanted to show you these sounds because it sort of says where the model's going. But right now I'm going to put the sounds first and the model second, even though they're very tied together. And so the question that Christoph asked his subjects was, which of these two sounds is most salient? And so here's one sound. Okay, that probably wins the saliency award. Anyway, that was just a simple question: which one's more salient? And I don't know if he told his subjects what salient meant.
Yeah.
Exactly. How to pick between. Yeah. Well, so his model actually dealt with loudness and compared itself to between the saliency map and loudness. So he wanted to explicitly say it wasn't just loudness, but. Yeah, that's difficult.
What do we mean actually operationally in terms of saliency? What's your working definition?
I'll talk about that more. It'll be in three slides. This is some stuff that Munya and her colleagues at Johns Hopkins have been doing. And they ask people to detect a change in the environment, I guess, in the sound environment, I guess. And I think that's the best way of saying it. So. So I hope all you heard that off-tune note or whatever. And so that was the kind of study she did. Here's another one. I think this one's really hard to find. I didn't hear it. Did you hear something pop out? Yeah, that one. Yeah, a little higher there. So those are musical examples. She also had some speech examples. Oops, I'm sorry. And in this case, they were a bunch of, it was a babble, a speech babble. And then they had some words that were on top of that in a language the subject didn't understand. And I actually don't know what the languages were. Kind of sounds like Japanese. And here's another example. I didn't hear it, did you? I didn't hear it. I think she did all of her, I think all of her distractors were in Japanese, but I don't remember for sure. But anyway, so she built her models around these kinds of data, and it's shown in a spectrogram here. You've got these backgrounds, the pitch and intensity are constrained, and then you have this foreground signal that's different in some aspect. And she looked at frequency and time and I forget what else. It's actually probably better just look at this thing because it shows. So pitch, intensity, timbre, and foreground and background. And she did this great study looking at D prime. So she said, okay, well, here's a pitch change of 2 semitones versus 6 semitones, and the subject's ability to detect it went from, well, I don't know, 3.5 to 4 as the frequency gap changed. And then some nature sounds. I guess she had nature sounds too. I didn't play any of those. And you know, she looked at all these different factors. So she has all this data that says for these kind of sounds, asking people to detect a change, this is how well they can do the task. And so that's the core for her salience experiments.
So it seems like another way, like if you mix that with spatial hearing, you would have an quote objective way to measure saliency, like you play two signals, or say some distractor and then some other signal from a different location, and you check, like, do people look there, or do they turn their heads or something? Have people looked at that?
I don't know of any studies like that. It's an interesting idea.
Even for these complex acoustic scenes, I guess you could have, you know, 360 degrees, surround environments, and then have many things going on. If you track a bit, like, again, require a lot to figure out what head movement needs what, but it would be more data in a way that we would compute them.
It's a good idea. We should look at it some more. I would worry, I don't want to say bad things about it, but I would worry that keeping people motivated to keep turning their heads might be challenging, but I'm not really a psychologist.
I guess it might happen automatically. Like, I think you could tell them.
Yeah.
That's not a good way. Ideally, it would happen automatically. I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah. Let me come back to that in two slides, I think. Because there's a whole bunch of issues about what does it mean to be salient and stuff. And here's a couple other possibilities. This is one that I did when I was at Yahoo many years ago. And It has a similar kind of flavor in the sense it's trying to see if things are different from the background in some fashion. And so we were working with the capture group to do some auditory captures, and we thought that might be a good choice of data.
Zero. Five. Zero. Six. Four. Five.
So.
Zero.
So in Munia's data, she's asking people, can you detect a change? And so it's a very low level decision. In this case, we're asking the same kind of thing, but we're asking people actually identify digits or identify words on top. So in a sense, it's a higher level version of the same kind of thing.
Or it's a foreground and background segmentation.
Segmentation issue too. Even though I did this, I think this is the least favorite of my definitions. And my current favorite is a paradigm that Maria proposed, I guess a couple of years ago. And I got involved because we've been, we're starting to do these tests on Amazon Turk, which we think will give us a lot more data a lot faster. And the Amazon Turk results in our pilot agreed perfectly with the results she got in the lab, with carefully paid subjects and all that kind of stuff. But the idea is we play people sound one and sound two and ask them if they're the same or not. That's easy. And then we make it interesting by putting a distractor in the middle. And so it's kind of a, maybe it's a kind of a dual task paradigm, I don't know. But anyway, so this is the kind of things we play to them. So this is, so no distractor there. It's, you know, just the same phone, if you will, playing both cases. Here's one with a distractor. Oh, sorry. That had no distractor. And they were different. So it's a fairly subtle difference between, you know, sound one and sound two. And then this makes it more challenging. Can you still tell if they're the same or different?
Same.
Different. I should have had people raise their hands. This one's actually really painful to work with because the biggest difference is in the low frequencies, and these laptops don't convey that low frequency information. So I have to get good speakers to test this. So we've got three different ways of measuring saliency, or three or four ways, maybe three ways primarily.
Sorry, Michael, what is this supposed to have to do with saliency?
Well, okay, sorry. So the idea is that if the sound is salient, if it distracts you,
if the middle sound
distracts you. Thank you for asking. The middle sound distracts you, then that's grabbed your attention and causes your performance to drop on the other task.
I thought you were looking at the salience of that sound three that you left out.
No. Sorry. Well, I'm sorry. We're looking at the middle sound salience.
You're looking at the salience of the distractor.
Right.
You could also. You can measure both.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you can regress on the salience of the distractor and the salience of the sound. If it was salient, you will remember it.
Yeah.
So,
Although I think...
I mean, it's a possibility.
Yeah, it's a possibility. So, I should have put a slide for this, but we essentially have three different ways of measuring saliency. One is asking people, which is more salient? The second way is what Mooney has been doing, where you ask people if they can detect a change. And the third way, in this case, is does the sound distract you from another task?
Did you also think about the distractor sound as masking information?
Oh, God.
We have to factor it out.
Yeah. Well, there's information on masking.
Yeah. It could be. I mean, it depends on the timing and the content of the signal.
That's a great question.
All of this is really non-energetic masking, I assume.
Right. It's not because they don't overlap.
Well, but there is such a signal for masking that we're about a couple of hundred milliseconds,
right?
And it looks to me the same thing as you are asking.
Like the fine salience is the ability to mask either energetically or
this may be energetic masking, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but you could define saliency as that with having energetic.
Every sound masks.
Yeah.
You can't help. And you can unmask.
I think the answer I'd like to give to you is I don't want to think about it in terms of masking because I don't know if I can not think about it that way. I guess I hadn't thought about it that way before. There's certainly informational masking. Informational masking takes into all these different kinds of things. And so you could claim this printer thing was masking the memory of the previous sound. But I don't like thinking that way.
Sorry, I don't know, and just to clarify what you mean. So here you're trying to figure out the salience of the distractor. And is the idea to then play a whole bunch of sounds and to try to characterize what makes something salient or not?
Right.
But that seems like that would be also context dependent. I know I said the C word.
Yeah.
But
No, that's fine. I'm okay with that now.
In the sense that what would distract me in one context might not distract me in another.
Exactly.
So can you even really define a distractor except with respect to the background or with respect to the...
You're perfectly right. And I think one of the reasons I like the Amazon Turk version of the experiment is that we can limit the number of times people see a distractor or see what's going on. So yeah, if you hear the printer often enough, it's not going to distract you anymore. You'll tune it out. And you know, we still have the issue that everybody's sitting in their own world, and everybody's world is different. And someone, you know, maybe grew up with a printer, and so they.
In a room full of printers, if a bird says chirp, a little tiny chirp, you might turn your head towards the bird.
I completely agree. And it's probably worse in the auditory domain because we don't actually have a real measure of attention of what you're looking at. But I think the same sort of thing exists in the visual case. It's just that it's a smaller effect and they haven't started looking at it. My favorite example is it's probably pretty clear that men and women look at pictures differently when people are involved. And that's a big context event. But as far as I know, the visual people haven't started looking at that either.
So in this case, Maria showed that there is a measure because she did this with tones and showed that if the task is to determine whether the first and the last sound are the same, then the neural representation of the intermediate sound is suppressed. So if one is actively ignoring that little sound,
right,
that makes your task hard not to ignore it, then there is a measure and one can, in some sense, unmask.
Yeah.
It would help probably if you can somehow manipulate the distance between the sounds. If a certain sound was further, then this objection of masking probably would go away.
Well, I think it gets at the issue of, you know, what is masking? Masking is sort of this overall arching, especially when talking about informational masking. It gets, a lot of stuff gets labeled that because it kind of looks like masking. I don't know. I really don't know how to answer your question. It's a great question.
So shouldn't the definition of salience to the destructive behavior influenced by the similarity between the destructor and the branching sound?
I'm going to call that a second order effect, but yes, definitely. That's going to show up in the modeling. It gets back to the environment again. You know, if you're hearing something and you're hearing a lot of it, then you know it'll have to be different from that to be salient or. You know, but actually, you know, if it's it's a complicated story. I really wish we had eye focus or eye gaze. anyway, so this is. I mean, you're asking lots of great questions, but this is sort of a summary of what I think the big problem is. I originally framed this before our discussion today is, are we more concerned with distractors or detectability? And detectability is probably a precursor to distraction. So if you can't hear it, or you can't hear a change, then probably won't distract you. I'm actually not sure how much I believe that. But, Mooney's been spending a lot of time, and she's a very, very, very bright woman, on detectability or detecting changes and building models like that. I'm very intrigued with this idea of distractors because it's a better fit to attention, if you will. So someone is asking what salience is or what is salient. And I like the idea of tying it into a real task and saying, okay, can you still perform the task, if your attention shifts? If your attention shifts, that's going to screw up your performance in the task. And so that seems to me like a very direct way of measuring salience. But the jury's still out. And I haven't had a chance to talk to Mooney about this distinction yet, so I don't know how she would respond.
I'm having a little trouble seeing the big picture, I think.
Okay.
You could construct very specific visual tasks along these lines and measure how things eye track, but what would be the point of that? And then sort of complementarily to that, we're speaking about salience as if it's some discoverable entity that we need to try to, collect data to figure out what it really is, but really it's just something we need to define and then construct experiments based on that definition, which is what people are doing. So I don't really understand what the overall goal is.
Well, I think the overall goal, the high-level goal is to understand how perception works, and a big part of that is attention and salience and how those all tie together into what you pay attention to in the world. And so as an engineer, I would love to break this feedback loop and have a purely, one-way system, and we don't have that. And so I'm intrigued with the idea. I guess the answer to your question is we're sort of coming at this from the edges. And one edge we're coming at it from is this salient event thing, because we know these things are out there. They grab your attention in some fashion. And if we can model that, then maybe we can, get it part of this loop. And then at the end of the talk, I'll talk about some of the attentional decoding stuff we've been doing in terms of measuring where your attention is from an EEG or ECOG experiment. So I think the answer to your question is there's nothing per se that's really important about saliency, except it's a way of getting entree to this loop and trying to figure out how this loop works.
But did the visual people define salience as that property which maximizes the probability that your next SACOD will go there or something?
Yeah, that's my question.
I think so. Okay. I don't want to speak for them.
Okay, but yeah, we can work with that. And so you're going to get to some sort of objective measures of auditory attention that would be analogous to eye tracking eventually.
Well,
at the end of the talk, that's what you just...
I don't care about eye tracking per se. I really care about attention. But eye tracking...
No, that would be an auditory analog of eye tracking,
yeah,
meaning an objective measure.
So what would be the auditory analog of eye tracking?
I don't know if he's going to tell us, right?
Well, there's going to be...
About the EEG,
I think it's really hard.
It's really hard because there's nothing...
Move back on the fourth one.
But are you trying to construct an algorithm, like, let's say, a microphone, an algorithm, or a computer processor, so that you can put it in a room full of very even loud noises, and it's going to tell you the important... If you've understood what the human would do, it's going to say the important sound stream was this talk.
Yeah.
And ignore me scribbling or this.
Yeah.
Is that the idea that it's going to guess what would be salient to a human?
So you're asking a very...
It's kind of like a functional definition of...
You're asking I should say I really play in both worlds. So I'm an engineer because I like to build things, and I'm in industrial labs because I like to build things that are practical. And so I have an engineering hat where I'm trying to build things that, respond to you because you're asking me questions, and I want my machines to do the same thing. And so that's the engineering question. The scientific question, which I also care about, which is I want to know how the brain works, I think like all you guys do. So I want to understand how this attention loop works and how it fits in to understanding perception. So I don't think there's a single answer to your question. Does that help?
Okay. I would suggest a different definition of salience.
Okay.
It has to do with memory. So we have a constant stream of information coming in, most of which we forget.
some of which we remember. So saliency would be, so that means that every event that happens in the sound stream is in some sense competing with the other events for retention in memory. So you could define saliency as the property that makes you remember one piece over all the others that you can forget. Now, for example, in Maria's experiment, you have a memory of the first half, you have to keep it until the second half. Then you have this competing sound that comes in and grabs a chunk of memory. It takes it away from your representation of the initial scene. Okay? So it's the power of this interferer to grab a chunk of memory that is no longer available for your task that could be a definition of saliency. And you could also define the saliency of the little bit that missed, that disappeared, as its ability to resist capture, the competition from the distractor. It's just a suggestion as a...
We talked to Maria about this.
The visual analog would be something like change detection in vision, where you have a scene, and then a mud splash, and then the same scene, but something is missing or not, and can you detect what is missing?
Yeah. Did you want to respond, or...?
Yeah, because I think that's limiting, because some pop-out effects, visual or auditory, I'm not sure how much they rely on memory or even interact with it. So something pops out, it doesn't have to affect memory.
Well, first you have to, in order to do an experiment with pop-out, you have to remember that something popped out.
No,
you don't have to remember.
Well, I mean, if you didn't notice it,
No, but
when
you notice
it,
you do notice it.
That means that it can notice it.
If it
didn't pop up, nothing special happened.
I think you're a good friend, so I can say it this way. I think my criticism with that approach would be, you know, if you're dealing with attention and saliency, it's going to affect all your processing.
Yeah, of course.
And so, you know, there's all sorts of issues with memory as it is. And what goes in and what you preserve and all that kind of stuff. And that seems like a second level measure of saliency. I mean, it's ineffective, but you know, you've got all the memory issues too involved. And so if I had my choice, I'd like to find a more direct method.
Okay.
I think that'd be my answer to your question. Do you wanna?
Oh, I was just thinking another important dimension is really stimulus selection. So I think in the visual domain, people are moving their eyes to
I don't know if I'll remember it later.
to scan a scene, you know, there may be some parallel that you can think of in audition that really focuses on the stimulus selection. Maybe ties into Munia's discrimination experiments, where there are certain features that are selected and therefore discriminated.
Perhaps.
And pop-out would fit into that.
Yeah, perhaps.
Can I just make a short comment? I mean, if we know what silence is in the visual world, then can we not define silence in the auditory domain as a stimulus that in the presence of a visual stimulus of a non-saliency reduces the performance and orientation or power effect of that visual stimulus to 50%?
Well, I think
would be equally silent.
So I mean,
we have an auditory stimulus there and the visual there. We know the silence of this one, 50%, so that one is equal in silence.
I mean, the visual people are smart. No, what I was trying to say is... This is being taped, right?
Those people are really smart. Even...
No, what I was trying to... What I wanted to say was that... I don't feel bad about it. A large amount of the work is being based on what eye tracking does, what the eyes do. And so I know there's visual people that don't just pay attention to the eyes, but a large amount of the work is said, well, where'd the eyes go? That's the signal we want. And that's how they're defining, I think that's how a large percentage of the people define saliency. And I suspect there's others that are much more subtle about it, like you're asking.
Well, what I have in mind is experiments by Eric Knudsen's lab, for example, where they're recording a single neurons in the tech by now. They present visual stimuli of a particular contrast and auditory stimuli of a particular contrast. And those neurons are binaural, so they respond to both.
Right.
And then if you present them in different locations, now automatically it reacts to either one of them. So then it's a winner-take-all process. And so you can calibrate the salience with auditory stimulus, knowing the salience and contrast of the visual. So you can do the same thing with humans.
Yeah. I know that work because I'm at Stanford, so I hadn't thought about that connection. I don't know what the connection is. I mean, it sounds very compelling. Need more barn owls, I guess. After I talk about the saliency, I want to talk a little bit about attention models. And maybe I should have put the attention models first, because I think the work we did sort of informed my view of salience. And maybe it was a bad direction to go, but there's a reason why I have this particular thing, because we tried to build a model of attention, full, top down, bottom up, very cartoon-like, but we built it actually, actually had it working in a lab, and that really informed my views of this. And maybe that was wrong, but I'm glad you guys are asking the questions. So I want to talk a little bit about bottom-up models, larger salience, just to give you a lay of the land. And as you might expect, the models all sort of look like this, which is what ED's model was. So there's a bunch of models that were directly based off the visual world, all just sort of changing the labels of the words here to auditory things, or adding things. Some work that people did on adding temporal cues, which I think is probably analogous to what the visual people have done, but I haven't really followed the movie. I haven't followed the moving image salience stuff that those people have done. And as you expect, there's at least one person doing this as a machine learning problem. And I'm not going to go into details on any of them, just to give you a flavor. But I did want to show Christoph Kaiser's approach, which was just a direct translation. I mean, it was a direct translation of ED's model into the auditory domain. The dumbest possible thing you can do. I'm really impressed with what he did. He was first. He did some other things I'll talk about in a second about what he did. It was really amazing. But this is really just the simplest thing you can imagine. So he has an intensity map looking for things that are, brighter than everything else. He looks at frequency contrast, so he has these Gabor-like things that are looking in a spectrogram domain for something that's bright and two things that are, subdued around it, and then doing the same thing in time domain. And the same kind of center surround and combination, and then he gives a saliency map. And except for, the words here, I think it's all the same as ED's model. And he did this, 12 years ago, and it was great. These are the kind of results he gets. So this is I actually don't remember what the sound was. I don't know if any of you guys can tell. Maybe some sort of, these look like chirps of some sort. I don't know what they are. So here's a spectrogram image. And then his map, his saliency map puts out these bright spots, these red spots that are highly salient. And so it's a very low-level model of saliency. And, it gets those things.
But why would saliency be the
type of
time? When saliency is a function of time, presumably.
Right.
So it looks just like the transform of the spectrogram.
Right, it is.
I mean, it doesn't get very far.
Right.
It's not just a function of time, it's about the source.
Right.
So it has frequency characteristics.
It's
trying to identify the event or the sound.
So he's looking at the whole, Dick's answer is right in the sense he's looking at this, at the whole spectrum going by in time.
Yeah,
and making decisions.
At the input level, yeah.
And what I don't remember is how he combined across frequencies. I think it's just a summation.
Is it in the architecture that you showed before?
It didn't show up here.
These are all hand-coded, hard-coded features, right?
Yeah.
Intensity.
Yeah. So I think it's just a sum across frequencies that says, pay attention here.
I mean, the problem with this kind of, I mean, defining saliency as something that occurs in the time continuum? Is it, I mean, when we decide that something is salient, it's a sluggish decision. And we say, oh, that sound is salient, and it takes us a little bit of time to realize it and to move on to the next one. So the temporal granularity is much, much larger. And also, I'm not sure that we think of, oh, that treats suicide.
Agreed.
Possibly if they're interleaved sources, you might be argument, but I...
Not all responses are sluggish.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but it depends on the stimulus, but you're going to have one, maybe you're going to react fast, but you're not going to do it on the every 10 milliseconds, have a similar reaction.
So, this result, well, yes, you're exactly right, except some things really make your attention grab it really fast. His experiments were driven, I think, by this question he asked the subjects, like, is this sound more salient than that sound? And so then there's this grand integration over time, frequency and time.
On the time scale, maybe half a second.
Yeah, something like that.
Better than any statistical models of saliency, so that would take into account time.
So the machine learning, and there's some that talk about entropy and time. I'll show those later. These are the kind of results that the first half of the models tended to use. And so they say, well, if you have a short tone and a long tone, then you should get responses to both the short and the long. If there's a gap, that'll show up. You get a little bit of a salient thing when the sound disappears, and then you get even more when it comes back. So these are Kaiser's results. You get a bigger response from changing modulated tones, and you go from stationary tones in his model, again, agreeing with what you might expect. And then you get, single and paired tones. So you get a big response from the first tone of the two, and then you get very little response from the second tone.
Why do we see that this modulated tone is more salient than a steady tone? I can't see it in this saliency map somehow.
Well, I think the fact that there's more red here than there are in these other four lines is the way I would argue it.
And how did in the bottom two panels, how did the second, the paired tone, how did the second one have a weaker response? Was that due to the, what in the architecture led
good
to
point.
That?
Good point. Probably the temporal contrast would have failed. So the second tone would have shown up,
okay.
I'm guessing. But I think the reason it would show up here is that the first tone would have a high spectral contrast and the second tone would have less spectral contrast because its predecessor was still on the filter. I think that's the answer to the question.
Some sort of change detection.
Yeah. And these are kind of results he got. So the red circles are, I'm sorry, he's looking at the correlation between human judgments and the model judgments. And he's doing two different models. One is a model based only on intensity, which is what the gray squares are. And the black circles are the model from the saliency. And saying, look, there's something more than intensity in the saliency signal. And that's shown here in a couple other different ways. He also asked people, I guess this is called detection, but he also asked the same thing. I mean, this is the data for humans. As he added noise. But I think that was really brilliant and amazing that he did, and I can't possibly criticize him because he actually made this work with monkeys, too. So he did the same kind of experiments with monkeys, and the monkeys had to detect these sounds and noise and do something, I forget what. They perform better on the more salient sounds, according to his model. So I thought it's really pretty amazing that he made this incredibly simple model work, both in humans and monkeys. And I think I haven't met him yet, but I'm going to congratulate him for that. We actually took this model a few years ago and tried to apply it, actually in Telluride, and it failed miserably. because we were trying to, we wanted to do things like speech and stuff like that. And the model just went crazy with speech. I mean, everything was salient when you started applying these more complicated signals. And the example I like to show is, sorry for the lousy looking spectrograms, but we had a tone, a harmonic complex, and a noise burst. And if these guys have the same energy, it doesn't show up very well here, there's a change in timbre from a single tone to a harmonic complex, but it's not that much more salient. But in Kaiser's model, you know, all these harmonics show up as something salient, and when you integrate across time, you get this really big signal. And so when we applied this to speech, it just sort of went, wow, got really excited, and you know, everything was salient, and it wasn't very useful.
Sorry, that signal is anticipating the stimulus.
Yeah, the timing's weird here. I'm not sure what's going on here.
I mean, it's very powerful, it's true.
Yeah.
Long windows and spectrograms will do that. Yeah.
I think the model had a windows and stuff, and so you shouldn't believe this relative offset too much. But this corresponds to this, and this corresponds to that. I don't think.
Time axis is
not meaningful. That wasn't part of his modeling effort. Getting time accurate saliency measures, and so, you know, it's not clear the implementation was done quite right.
So it sounds like the Kaiser saliency metric was kind of, it treated the spectrogram as an image, and
yes.
then kind of basically looked for edges,
yes.
accentuate edges, whether
yes.
spectrally or temporally in
yes.
the image.
Not causal.
It's not causal, it ignores objectness, another way of saying it. So then you need some way of grouping together multiple salient or Kaiser salient things into one.
Right,
which he doesn't do.
And actually, none of these models really have a model of scene analysis. So none of them really measure objectness. That's a bad word. I'm going to blast through a couple models, but just to give you a flavor. So Aslam Kalini, just took Kaiser's model and added this pitch thing on the side. And she was trying to look at pitch as a symbol of interest or saliency. And she was actually using it in a study to predict prominence in spoken utterances. So she had some BBC announcers, I think, saying things. And she wanted to use the pitch signal to predict which parts were most important in the speech signal. Get my mouse back here.
I'm Irene Doyle.
So I'm Irene Doyle was what she was looking for in her work. And she actually did the same kind of focus of attention that the visual people did. I mean, you first hear this and then you move to that. Again, just translating one to the other. This group at Georgia Tech did the same kind of thing, but they did it in terms of STRFs, in terms of Gabors and stuff. And so you have the energy, the temporal, the spectral, and I forget what the high temporal and spectral case was. But again, it's the same kind of multiple channel stuff. Do some filtering and combine them and get a saliency map. And again, the same kind of results. Here's for a modulated tone, and you get a much more salient effect when this thing is happening. I guess this is a little uptick in the frequency, and I guess that's some tones buried in noise, and you see what they get. This is way too complicated, but the main thing that these guys did is they talked about in terms of entropy. So a lot of people in the visual world talk about saliency in terms of information gain, if you will. And so, and one way of measuring that is entropy, and so, or surprise. So the visual people look at surprise as a measure of saliency, and entropy is one way of calculating that. And so basically the same sort of model as ED and stuff, but they framed it all in terms of entropy and stuff, which I guess is, I'm not sure where that shows up here. But you can do the same.
So how is the entropy applied here?
Well, it's the idea that if something new happens, that's going to be salient.
And so what happens to entropy of all the world?
model, or what is entropy?
Well, the basic idea of the saliency model is to measure entropy, and that's your basic feature for measuring
of
the signal coming in. So if it's this has got some entropy.
So low entropy is good.
No, well, low entropy means that nothing new is nothing's happening. It's all fairly quiet. And then when something changes, then that's surprising, and that's going to be salient, and the entropy goes up. Again, they were actually measuring this on sirens and footsteps, horse footsteps. The Johns Hopkins group sort of coded this idea of entropy in terms of Kalman filters and saying, spike when something is unexpected happening. The same kind of thing. They have these big feature maps, and they get good results. Again, this is actually applying their change detection. This is the data I showed you before where there's a tone or something that sort of popped out of the background. And so they're applying this model to that. So they're looking at human versus model saliency and showing these kind of curves, saying how well do they match up between humans and the model. And
can't quite tell what the correlations, R squared, are there.
They're not very large, but they're positive and they're happy. And Mervé hasn't quite escaped, hasn't quite graduated yet, so maybe they're not as good as we hoped. This gets back to the issue that someone brought up earlier about context. So they looked at this model and said, well, here's all these features we have, and how do they contribute to the final outcome? And they drew this sort of map showing how they all fit together. But the thing that was interesting is they said, oh, look, depending on the kind of sound, these different features have different importance. And I think part of it's the fact that, it depends on context. And so, in some kind of music, some things are more important than other things. And I think part of it's the fact that this is a highly nonlinear effect. And so reducing it all to a single, set of factors when the data is so messy back here, it's probably not going to be very meaningful. And then you can do the same sort of thing with machine learning. This is actually an interesting experimental paradigm. The speech recognition community has recorded these meetings. And so one of their typical tasks is a thing called meeting recorder. And they want to understand how a meeting happens. So you have, 20 people around a table, you have all these microphones, and you want to capture all the meaning in the meeting. So who's talking when, who's talking to who, overlapping, all that kind of stuff. So these, and it's a fairly natural environment in a sense, and you get lots of data like this. And so he was trying to ask people, when something salient happens, mark the moment when you hear any sound which is unintentionally pay attention to or which attracts your attention. And this is the kind of data they had.
So
I'm sure you guys were wondering what was salient, and then once it happened, it was pretty salient. But they could get lots of data this way, and they built a model, and it works to some level of performance.
So they generated that data set by asking people to perform a task on that purpose?
Yeah. So
people, this entropy idea I think is interesting, and so I guess the saliency thing might be something that also in a way is learned as we react to things that are way out, like somebody making this and so on while speaking. But then it means that actually with like wavelengths or RNNs, you might actually be able to extract it if you have whatever huge amounts of data from speech, from natural scenes, from all kind of stuff, which I think people have been trying to analyze that in terms of what statistics. What is surprising in which context, and then assign back to salience. People look into something like that.
You mentioned that it's pure entropy. I still have a problem with that. So for entropy, I can imagine I need some probability somewhere or something, some model, right?
And yeah.
I don't know how to apply it except for maybe what Izzy was trying to do. He was trying to change the model, looking how much set of models change or something, but I don't know how can I use the entropy otherwise. I need some model and some probability.
Well, you can define entropy over any probability distribution.
I guess, and that has to be derived somehow.
And you know, they're making this, we're making this up. I was going to say they. We are making this up as a community.
Because entropy just measures the, I mean, it just measures the uncertainty in a probability distribution, right? So how is it so different from surprisal?
Entropy. Well, that's, they're using entropy as a measure of surprise.
What? As a measure of surprise with respect to a model of some sort. So like if,
yeah.
If I say happy birthday to, and you expect me to say the next word to be you, so that it should be low entropy for that prediction, because you know the next word is going to be you. But what if I say something else like to, I replace it with some other word, then that would be surprising.
But
that kind of surprise relative to any sequential model, right? You're going to have some prediction, and then data will come in and either confirm the prediction or invalidate it, and maybe it's a little surprising. But that kind of saliency seems
pleasing.
Well, it seems like different and more easily definable than the more general kind of saliency, where any stimulus to which you have a high probability of attending to, either visually or like that, seems more general.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I'm a computational person, so I'm very biased toward the entropy Bayesian approaches.
So the surprise is defined if you take the Schmidhuber or ATP and Baldi, and it's defined by having a set of models. So, and then you have a set of models before the experiment and after the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And you measure the tail variations between models after the experiment and before the experiment. If there is no change, there is no surprise. If there is a lot of change, there is a lot of surprise. But for this, I need a model. And it's not so much to do with the entropy, except that maybe if you want to, you can compute entropy of the output of the model, but I don't see it, basically.
You're saying here with these architectures, you don't see the model? Like,
I don't see the, and how do you use the entropy? But maybe it's a look a little bit closer to what you consider Wang, or who was in
there? Wang, yeah.
And, I mean, you should,
I don't see how you can score it either.
Yeah.
As you say with speech, you have a corpus of words, you can talk about frequencies, probabilities, etc. So in that sense, you could define something. But if you're looking at arbitrary sounds, I don't know how.
Let's say you have a posterior distribution over the spectrogram, right? Over the next delta t, you say, I expect the spectrogram.
You just chunk the thing up.
I mean, they're doing it in terms of feature space. They're designing a feature space by hand and measuring the entropy of that feature space over the output of that feature map over time. So it's a very ad hoc. I mean, it's got this mathematical entropy around it, but it's very ad hoc based on the features.
Oh, you're saying they take the output of the feature maps
and
they measure the entropy of that. What is that? So they take the distribution of the outputs and they say how much entropy is in the distribution.
Yes.
I don't know what that
means. You're not as pleased anymore.
Yeah.
You were asking a question, yeah.
Not this.
Go back a slide, please.
This one.
So you've got a thing in quotes there. I didn't know if you're interested.
This is what they asked the subjects. This is what they said they asked the subjects.
It seems to me that it's quite subtle, but what you've got there is a slightly different definition. In that when people were giving you a hard time earlier on in the talk, you were defining salience in a kind of wishy-washy way. It's whatever you want it to be. But in saying that, you're actually defining an output target. You're saying, tell me when you pay attention to something that was otherwise different to before. And it seems to me that kind of tie-in to a higher level semantic is important to define something like saliency.
I agree with you. Operationally, I mean, there's people that do this better than I do, but operationally I have a hard time with this particular definition because it, you know, the subject has to set a threshold and say, okay, was this surprising? And so I think it's really hard to make sense of what's coming out of this kind of result. So yes, I mean, maybe calling what I said before wishy-washy is fair. and this is certainly much better defined. I mean, it's in quotes. But I find this one harder to deal with.
It's also difficult to manage the timelines. So, mark the moment, but at what moment do you mark?
Right. Yeah.
So presumably you're going to be heard presented a chunk and then you have to move back in time.
Yeah.
But that's sort of mental gymnastics.
Yeah.
Unless you have some sort of speech editor and you can play it back.
Yeah.
It's really involved
paradigm.
Yeah.
Experimental paradigm, yeah.
Maybe I can add that, are you aware of a guy called Al Gore at MIT too?
I know him, yeah.
So he did this work called How May I Help You?
Right.
Where the AT&T operator says, how can I help you? And then the caller just says says whatever they want. Well, he defined this measure that he called exactly saliency, which was a kind of information theoretic score that you would put on words that said how indicative a word was about whether you should be put through to a particular operator.
Oh, okay.
And the interesting thing there is it was learned.
Right.
And it wasn't just a measure, it had a direct tie from a word to a particular outcome.
Exactly.
And that's, I mean, in listening to you talk, that definition is the one that's stuck in my mind. So when I hear the things that are called wishy-washy, I'm sorry.
I'm okay with that.
I say that because that's the definition that's stuck in my mind.
Right.
And when I point out a thing in quotes, I feel happier about it because there is a tie to a higher level semantic.
I
just need to say it.
Yeah, I don't know. We should talk more about that. I want to say a little bit about top-down. I'm going to skip a bunch of stuff, but just to help tie it all together again, and maybe some of the stuff will explain where I'm coming from. There's a lot of people that I actually don't know if there's a settled consensus about how it's actually implemented in the brain. And so you can imagine with attention, you get a change in the filter height. And so in this case, you know, if you're focusing on something or attending to something, you know, looking for food items, then that'll raise this bump, or you can imagine how it makes things sharper, the response sharper. You know, there's been very little work on this in the auditory domain. This is some SGRF work looking at how people's SGRFs changed over, I need to get his attention, over time when they were asked to change their task. And so, you know, here's what the neuron looked like at the start of the task. They were asked to do one kind of task, and it changes. And then, you know, 40 seconds later, 50 seconds later, it changes back to the original. And then, you know, they can change it back and forth. So there hasn't been much work on what this looks like in the brain, in the auditory system. I've seen models that talk about both these things in the visual system, but I don't know if there's a consensus. Nima Mascherani, starting with work in Shihab's lab, and then at UCSF and now at Columbia, has been looking at these attention decoding tasks where people hear these sentences and want to, you know what they're attending to. And so they hear these two things, and when you hear the keyword Ringo, you're supposed to listen to that speaker. So they hear the two sentences you just heard, and the response was, well, they heard Ringo, and so they're supposed to hit red and two is the outcome. And what he's done with this is he's got these are the spectrogram maps, but he's done these experiments and he's asked people to pay attention, do the task, and then he's using the ECOG signals to measure the brain response to the attended signal, and it's really quite brilliant and it works really well. And
Ready Tiger, go to green 5 now.
Ready Ringo, go to red 2 now.
And there's all the spectrograms involved. And what I think what's most interesting about this is looking at this measure of attention that he has based on how much the correlation is between the attended and the original speech. And I think what's really interesting is, you know, this thing is flat until you get the call sign, and then it sort of grows into a peak as you listen to one speech signal or the other. And so I think this is a really, really compelling result that I like a lot. And so we've been working a lot on doing this kind of study with EEG in Telluride and other places. The EEG community uses EEG signals a lot for brain-computer interfaces. And so the typical example is, you know, the person is doing some task, either looking at something or hearing something, and you're trying to decode it and say, okay, well, you know, this person wants to type the letter A. And so there's all these kind of experiments that are looking at that. And what we're trying to do instead is look at what are they actually attending to. And the way we do that is this, the person is listening to two stories like they did before. the brain's responding and getting all these channels, and we're trying to say, just like Nima did, with which one they're looking to. There's a practical question of, can you tell what they're listening to? I'm also very interested in, how does the brain representing the sound? And so the way I like to make a cartoon out of this is that these signals are going into the brain, and one signal is attended to, and so it goes through the entire processing chain in some fashion and goes all the way up into the brain and makes some action. And the other signal stops, if you will, somewhere. And again, this is a cartoon, but I really like to know what this looks like, because obviously there are differences. So if you put the person's name in the unattended stream, obviously that's going to grab your attention. So again, where does the signal stop? This is another picture of the same thing. We're actually doing this with stimulus reconstruction. So given the signal coming in, we want to predict what the original speech was and then measure the correlations. In the interest of time, I should probably skip this, but this had a big effect on my view of the world. A friend of mine who doesn't like to take credit for it looks at these EEG experiments and says, is this just another form of phrenology? And it's very dismissive. I mean, I heard it, it's like, oh, that sort of made 20 years of EEG experiments make sense to me. It is a sense of phrenology in the sense that they're looking at these bumps and how they're changing, but there's really science to be done there, because they're actually seeing these bumps move under, they can control where they go and they can get information out of this. So, but I don't want to do this. I don't want to look at bumps. I don't want to, be looking at a lot of averaging to try to figure out whether this bump is moving or come or gone or not. And so we've been pushing this idea of building decoders for this. And so a couple years ago, we put together this Telluride decoding toolbox because we were doing these EEG experiments, and we didn't, it wasn't working. And we didn't know if it was because our software was broken or because our signals weren't there. And so I've been putting a lot of effort into, I want to get a baseline set of modules here that we can publish. They're already out on the web that people can use. We know how they perform. And I'm hoping everybody else in the world beats this performance. So I want these to be the baseline methods that people use. I want them to be good, but I'd be very happy if people exceeded their performance. And the basic toolbox looks like this. You've got multiple speakers coming in. They go into the brain. You get EEG signals. And then the three kinds of processing going on. You can build linear models that predict the speech from the EEG. You can do some nonlinear work with DNNs, which right now looks like the best approach, and then canonical correlations, another way of connecting speech and EEG signals. And the whole goal is to get a signal that we can then use to pick which one is the winner, which one are you attending to. And so this work has been out for a while. NEMA's using it. There's a bunch of labs that are doing this kind of experiments, and they're working well. And you get these kind of results out. This is results that Ed Lawler did, looking at how accurate was the decoding as a function of time. So with a very short amount of time, this is a function of subject, sorry. So, and then sorted by subject number and performance. So some of the subjects were up at 100%. Some were not so good, or one wasn't so good. So in general, we can do this. This is looking at performance as a function of the attended stream. So this is the arrow that goes all the way up. And then as a function of the unattended stream. So the same architecture applies both directions. And the unattended stream has, quote, less information available. It is not going as far up. And so you get less performance on the unattended stream.
What are you decoding? And what are you trying to reconstruct? The envelope? Or
just the envelope in this case. This work was done with just the envelope, which is a really lousy feature. And I want to explore all the different options.
It's probably good for figuring out which speaker is being attended to.
Well, it works. But I would hope that phonemes or something else would work better. And NEMA's done some work in ECOG, and I don't think there's been a really good comparison of all the different features. So one of the things I want to do when I get the toolbox done is get some really long recordings and apply these tools to these really long recordings where we have plenty of data and see what works well and what doesn't. Because I hate intensity as a feature. But, it works. Here's the same thing as a function of time. I'm sorry, yeah, as a function of time. So here's 10 seconds up to 60 seconds. And so when you have 60 seconds, you do better. There's lots of data here. There's some correlation with performance, which I think is interesting, and I'm not going to go into. I wanted to say a few words about, maybe I should put this first, what motivated me or what got me started on this and what informed my thinking. So several years ago in Telluride, we had this three-week workshop and we wanted to do something on attention. And this workshop is heavily demo-oriented. So we have 3 weeks to do some science, to do some pilots, and then we have a big demo session at the end where we show what we've done. And there are a lot of people, I mean, we're trying to do science, but there's a lot of people that actually build things. And so we built something to try to make sense of it all. And I should have, see, it's salient.
Context.
With context, which should make it less salient. So we built a system that we wanted to attend your conversations. And so we wanted to predict what our subject was going to be listening to. And he had two people speaking to him. And it's a really rich environment because there's all sorts of things that motivate different subjects, food, everything else. And so we abstracted that into a very simple experiment where we said, let's represent the data in terms of numbers. And so the subject's task was to listen to these digit strings and say which one was higher value. Well, value was just defined in terms of numerical value. And so in this case, they should start out listening to the woman, and then I guess the woman for a while, and then anyway. And this was a cartoon version of what happens in real life where, depending on your mood and your needs, you're looking at sex or food or whatever else you're trying to do that's going to be directing your attention. So we didn't want to deal with all the really high-level stuff. But our goal was to build a system that could mimic this. And we simplified it a lot. But I think it has all the right pieces, and that informed my views of salience and stuff. So people were asking before why we had the particular definition of salience. I think it came about from trying to build this system and trying to make it work that made this happen. So we had these sentences, two-digit sentences. Again, very cartoonish, and we built this little speech recognizer based on attention that could pick the high value stream. Oh, it's not there. Sorry. I think that. So this is a model we built, and it worked. We actually built it. It actually could be used to do speech recognition in this attention paradigm where it was trying to pick the high value stream. And this is what it looked like. And again, this is built based on the tools we had at the time. So. I don't want to be held to any one particular box here, but it has all the pieces. So we had some hardware that could do binaural cochleas. And so we had this binaural receiver, two microphones, and we could shift the attention between the left channel and the right channel. And so the way the system worked is, the subject was listening to two audio streams, they're going to a binaural receiver, computing the ITD, and then our novelty salience detector, so this is what we talked about in the first half of the talk, in this case was just measuring, is there something new happening in the left side or the right side? I mean, more primitive than all the models I talked about. But, the idea was that here's a saliency box that could say left side or right side. And that went into a box called cognition. And then the cognition box was saying, okay, given my information needs, am I looking for food or sex or high numbers, whatever, then shift the attention between the left channel and the right channel. And so then it was telling the speech recognition system, automatic speech recognition system, pay attention to the male side or the female side. I guess these are male and female, or left side or right side. And then obviously the recognition fed its results back up to the cognition box because the cognition box had to perceive what was going on and be able to say, do I really care about the woman or do I listen to the man? So this was our argument about this was our straw man, if you will, of an architecture for actually attending to speech. And it has all the great pieces. It has the recognition, it has the salience detector, it has the cognition, even though they're very, very, very primitive. And this definitely informed my views of what we want out of a saliency measure. You want something that tracks attention one place or the other. So the salience is going up on the left, on the right-hand side, attention is being directed on the left-hand side here. And these are the kind of results we got. This is the ITD map. So it's shifting between one side and the other side. And then the saliency map was looking for changes in this ITD map. And so every time there's a change, you get a spike. So this particular change here corresponds to the green line. So there's a green saline signal saying, oh, maybe there's something interesting here. And then the right, I can't line it up here. Anyway, the left and the right channels are shown here, and the green and blue are shown there, and they correspond to the edges of this guy. And then the cognition box had to decide who to listen to. And just, we had to do something there. And so what the cognition box was saying was very simple. If you've heard a high digit to start with, so you've heard like 6, 7, 8, or 9 at the start of a sentence, then it's probably going to be high value. So keep listening there. And if you heard a low digit and something else happens in the other channel, then go ahead and switch because it's probably not going to be useful. So if you've already heard a 1 and then something happens on the other side, you say, oh, I'm going to give up on the 1 because it's not going to be very high. Let's go listen to the other side. And in real life, you'd want to do things with history and context. And obviously, the woman's smarter than the man, so you want to listen to the woman more, you know, whatever else is going on. But in our case, we just had these very, very simple rules saying, you know, look at the last digit you've heard and make a decision about whether you stay there or go ahead and opportunistically take the other side. And we showed that, you know, I mean, it's kind of a silly task, but we showed that we got better performance in terms of getting the higher value when we were smart about what digit we looked to and how often we switched. So, I mean, one alternative you could think of is every time something new comes in, you switch to the other side. You know, that would sort of be the ADHD approach. Not meant in any bad way. And, you know, there's lots of things you can do better. But anyway, we had all those boxes together and it was good. And then finally, just to close up, I wanted to talk about why we care about this sort of thing and what we've been doing with it, with attention signals in the applied world. I think this is a great cartoon because wife has more priority than everything else. But there's lots of things we can do with this. The hearing aid people would dearly love to know whether you're attending to speech or music, for example. So the very simplest thing that we could do, are you listening to speech, you do one kind of processing. If you're listening to music, you do another kind of processing. And that signal alone would be worth a lot to them. And so we'd like to know that kind of thing. When I was at Microsoft, we're actually looking at eye gaze as a signal. So we're not doing this in the auditory domain. This is in the visual domain. And we were trying to say, if we had information about what the eyes were doing, can we do a better job of speech recognition? So it's a little non-intuitive, but the paradigm was, you have a screen and your voice. And so screens are great because you get a lot of information out of a screen. You know, you can put something on a screen and a person can look at it and decide which part they want to look at. It's very fast to scan. And then you want to respond to the voice because voice is so natural and so fast. And so the paradigm we're looking at was this combined visual output, you know, speech input. And we can use the eye gaze to help inform what the user is doing. So we did a pilot experiment. Actually, I should have put the slide on. We did a pilot experiment where we had a subject come in to the lab, and they had to perform these tasks. So they had to, you know, find this obscure form on the DMV website, or they had to buy a concert ticket, or they had to book some travel stuff. And, you know, this is before we had any system build up. So we had a human sitting in the, you know, behind a, you know, curtain, actually performing the actions. And he was looking at the subject's eye tracking data in real time. So he had a screen showing what they were seeing, plus he was seeing the eye tracking data on top of the screen. Before the user spoke, he knew what they were going to ask. And part of that's because he knew the task. And so he knew that, you know, in order to get here, you have to go here and here and here. But the eye tracking data told him everything he needed to know about what the speech recognition was going to tell him. And, you know, we built a system to, you know, operationalize this. In this case, we had people reading random lines from a page of news. So we put up the New York Times front page, and the subject had to pick a sentence and read it. And our task as a machine was to recognize the speech as well as possible. And what we wanted to do was to see if we could use the eye tracking data to help inform what they might be talking about. And there's all sorts of issues about time and radius. So, you know, they're scanning this page. This is the eye tracking data. And they're scanning this page looking for something to say, and then they start reading it, and then they're, before they even finish saying it, their eyes are off somewhere else. So it's a fairly noisy signal. There's saccades all over the place. And the typical way of doing speech recognition in this kind of environment is you have a speech recognition system that has speech coming in, and you have a language model coming in. And the language model is saying, how likely is this word to follow this other word? And so in this context, except I already did it once, elephant has a very low context, a very low likelihood in this scenario. And so it's not very likely it's going to happen that changes the system. So ideally, you'd like to change this language model and do it all in one box. What we did instead, just because this is the way the system was built up, is we did that with a generic page, generic or page-specific language model. So a generic model is everything you could possibly say. The page-specific language model was, here's the language model for the words on the page. So, you know, the U.S. president, you know, president would have a high likelihood on New York Times front page. And so we did that this way, and so this is sort of our baseline model. And then once we got results out, then we rescored it using a gaze-specific language model. And the gaze-specific language model is saying, okay, which words did you look at in some window in time and space before you said your utterance? And so then we did a rescoring. And what that means is, you know, when you do a speech recognition system, you get these word lattices out. And so, for example, you know, from this acoustic cues, you might get a, this is a test sentence would come out. And if you incorporate the eye gaze data and they were looking at guest for some reason, then you might change it to be this other path of the network. And the results we got are things like this. If you look, perplexity is a measure of how complicated the language model is. So, you know, normal speech with a good language model might have a perplexity of 60. With a generic language model, so this is a multi-million word language model. I mean, it's a very large Microsoft baseline model. The perplexity was very large. I mean, lots of things could follow everything else. If you look at the generic language model plus a page language model, the perplexity went down to 26. So an average of 26 words could follow any other words. And what we were happy with is if you added the gaze information, the perplexity dropped by a factor of 2. So basically it said the number of words you could expect next and the difficulty of the task went down by a factor of 2. And so that was a good result. And just one last little quick demo. This was the little demo we did showing, it's really hard to demonstrate this because it's such a subtle effect, but important. And this was a case where we had a bunch of similar sounding sentences. So the classic speech recognition case is recognized speech has very similar phonemes to recognized speech. And in this demo, in this particular example showing here, I was very carefully saying recognized speech, but I was looking at this box. And so we had tuned the system so that it would recognize it as with the visual side dominant. And so this is what the system actually running. Oops. So I'm looking up here.
Speech.
That's what I just showed you.
Recognize speech.
I was trying to do the opposite of that case. Recognize speech, but I was looking down there.
Microsoft Office.
That case is, you know, it's recognition is the same either way.
You know legal?
So the point of this is that there's value in the attention cues, both from a commercial side, and I'd really like to know how it works on the scientific side. And you know, maybe in the time we have left, here's some questions that I thought of beforehand, and I think you guys would add some questions to this. It certainly made me think about some other things. But you know, I would really like to know what the right definition of saliency is, so we can start collecting some data. And if you guys have ideas, that'd be great. So thank you.
Can I ask again the question that I asked in the beginning? So does covert attention exist in auditory? If it doesn't, then what kind of attention is auditory attention more similar to covert or covert?
I haven't thought about that question before. I mean, you certainly can monitor something in the background. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say I don't think there's a covert attention.
Well, what would overt mean in the auditory case? It's not like with your eyes where you point them at what you're attending, where someone can tell what you're attending.
Well, that's why I don't know the answer to this question. I'm just wondering if it's similar.
It's all covert.
Is it more similar to overt attention than the visual?
Well, what is the difference between them and vision other than,
other than
the eyes? I mean, what is it internally when you're attending to something, what's the relevant difference?
Well, I guess the way distractors and the thing you're attending to interact is different in the overt and covert cases.
Actually, I was thinking about a different question. So do you mean from the point of view from the external person? Or do you mean from your internal side?
Right, because in the visual domain, you can focus at a point, at an object, and that will and attend to it, and that is overt attention. Or you can focus on something, fixate at a point, but be actually attending elsewhere.
Right.
And that's covert attention.
So well, I think the question is whether there's something analogous to foveated vision. Like when you point your fovea somewhere to get high resolution, is there anything like that in hearing?
That's visible on the outside. So I don't think there is.
Well, even if it's not visible, is there anything like that attention-wise? That's so
auditory?
Yeah.
Well, Dan Tolan has looked at both visual and auditory attention in cats and tasks while they're doing it. And the cats, unlike us, can move their ears and their eyes. And so when their task, of course, it's not solving your question and your problem of how you define saliency, but you can design the task where they get rewarded for orienting towards a sound or a visual stimulus. And it turns out that, interestingly enough, if you have a sound coming off your side, a cat will actually will saccade to the sound first, and then their ears follow, right? And so the idea there is that either in the superior colliculus and or IC, there is a coordinated, framework for egocentric space, right? And so I think that, that's all we know about is the frame, that there's a framework there. How you operationally define it, I think people, covert and overt, there's some people would be highly insulted to say that they're not both existing, right?
Yeah.
Because some people, but I think they would define it almost like you did in the beginning where, that's a long discussion.
So that provides an interesting idea. If it goes back to the old statement that the purpose of the ears is to steer the eyes. if you had a cacophony of sounds all around and you wanted to know when something salient happens, you just use an eye tracker, right? So you hear something over there, your eyes are going to go that way.
Yes.
That's what happens.
I'll qualify that, though. If you're a rat, you lack a phobia. Or in other animals that lack phobia,
mm-hmm.
and therefore there's no rationale, no reason, no advantage for doing that. It's a primate who has a phobia that must do that. That's how they see the world with high resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a uniquely primate
or a cat.
Thing.
What about
and a cat? Cat. No, a cat. I'm sorry.
Mammals.
It's mammals that have a phobia, right?
Or areas
that want to direct that there. In fact, as I've tested human subjects and macaque monkeys on tasks, where basically I'm trying to purposely test their ability to see space-time trade-offs and structure for motion stimuli in the periphery, and I design the stimulus in such a way that it's actually easier for them to see it if they don't look directly at it, and yet we have this almost obligatory, something salient and moving over there, I gotta look at it, and so I had to actually train them not to look at it to see the emergent pattern. So it is a very powerful thing behaviorally, I think.
Well, actually, the difference between covert and overt attention is not just because of the phobia. So marmosets, for example, they don't have covert attention, but they have excellent vision.
Yes.
It's more linked to the sort of social hierarchies in the primate world where direct staring at a specific threat. So like lower, not dominant animals, they will pay attention to what's going on in the
And marmosets don't do that?
No, because they're not aggressive, yeah. they look like macaques. So macaques would avoid direct gaze because it's a threat.
But my guess is, my guess is that if you looked at it a little closer, I mean, I have no evidence, but Rob Fromke has actually shown, and they, even in mice, I think it was mice or rats, basically that when you're doing pup retrieval, that a naive female that's never retrieved a pup or really recognized what's important about a pup sound will actually, they actually communicate with orienting towards one another and interacting socially. So I would argue that maybe the marmoset has something that we just haven't discovered it.
Well, but this is overt attention. They have overt attention. They don't have covert attention. Because there's no threat for them to just look at the thing. As you said,
they must have some covert. But I don't know, that's not here.
So I might argue that covert attention, well, versus over, might come more into play when you incorporate other sensory systems which can direct attention. So, for example, if you incorporate the vision system, some work in Maria Chase groups was showing that if you point your vision or your gaze where you're attending, then you have some alpha effects which suppress the side in the auditory cortex. Where you're not listening to. Whereas if you're just, say, looking like in a standard experiment where your vision is fixed, that might be more covert attention.
I guess this is what I'm trying to get to. So maybe in the auditory domain, the attention is overt when the thing that you're listening to is the same object you're looking at. So,
that's the way.
Otherwise, it's overt. Why
is that the right distinction? Go ahead, answer Heather first.
Could you repeat it? Which one's over and
cover? So if you're looking at the object you're listening to, so if your visual attention and auditory attention are sort of aligned in the optic tectum superior
clinic, that would be overt.
That would be overt.
I think most people would agree.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And that would be overt in the auditory.
But you have to get careful because you know, as soon as you get to the parietal system, they have a whole way of representing these in somatic domain as well. And there, Graziano showed that your framework then shifts to your hands and your, I mean, so, but there certainly is an egocentric framework that aligns the eyes and the head. And so I don't see why it wouldn't be okay to call it over when you're oriented towards it.
Mm-hmm.
The covert, I agree, covert might be harder to, yeah, it's harder to define, it's particularly in an animal. You have to train it to respond to something, and that in itself is sort of prompting it to exhibit some overt response.
So why do you ask the question? It seems, I mean, except as a cue for what you're attending to, it doesn't seem like an important distinction. I mean, I think something.
The salience is all about
right.
Finding that cue.
Right. But whether it's overt or covert.
Yeah.
Well, if the neurobiological mechanisms are not the same, overt and covert, then it's important to ask this question. Because those differences exist in the auditory system, therefore
right.
We have to define things.
But let's say we just wanted to do some engineering and solve the cocktail party problem or the attending problem. Is the distinction between covert and overt? Like, how would you modify the block diagrams that he was showing in the architectures?
I would do it with all work.
Well, if you could come up with a conditional that you would allow you to predict where next eye saccade will be, that would kind of somehow give you back information about what the covert. The covert
either way,
ones, the
so
non-oriented
of,
one. What?
Yeah. If we define it in terms of behaviors that the agent, like whether it be eye tracking or something,
or head orientation.
But the case he said, like if you're just gossip, if you're listening to gossip, if I'm like, you know, like, I'm doing this, and I'm listening to, you know, what Pascal is saying or something, like then it becomes very hard to do that. But I think to first order, you'd probably just like to predict out where eye gaze is going to begin with, right?
I mean, they've shown even in rats and that rats can actually learn from other animals, watching them socially interact, and without necessarily, you know, the trick is they don't, in those little animals, they don't do a lot of studies to really distinguish what we would call overt and covert.
Yeah. I'd like to turn the problem around. What I'd really like to be able to do is use eye tracking data to tune HRTS. So if you had a video game going on and some sound happened over there, then you could use your eyes to say, well, you know, did you get the right HRTS?
Well, or to increase your sampling rate when you're looking at something for that direction.
Well, people have done that for visual case already.
Yeah.
So they do foveation in the displays.
Yeah, that would be one.
But I want to use the startle reflex, if you will, to say, okay, did you look in the right spot? And then tune the HRTFs.
What's an HRTF?
Head-related transfer function. So it's what gives you 3D sound from two speakers in the ears, canals.
You started very nicely in the first slides.
As opposed to the rest?
No, I was saying that somehow because there was this slide where you had bottom up and top down,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I got somehow lost. I had to admit. So can we somehow go back? What do you think? What is more important in case of, say, human?
They're both inherently involved. I mean, there's no way it's separate. It's very hard to separate.
There's no doubt about it. Right?
I mean, they have different functions.
But in case of, like, I always wonder about this cocktail party effect. And I'm kind of strongly feel that this must be top-down effect where you sort of build, you know, follow the particular language model, particular the stream of the sword. And that, at least that's what I kind of see I'm doing when I'm
right.
Listening for something. I remember once I was at the literally cocktail party, and I couldn't understand the scene. There was a bunch of Chinese students, because I assumed they speak the Mandarin. And then mm-hmm. Suddenly I realized I started understanding because they spoke English.
Right.
And suddenly I could follow everything, and I saw, well, you know, here it comes the cocktail party.
My experience was even more amazing because it was a cocktail party in English, and I realized I could understand the native speakers English better than the non-natives.
Yeah,
so one-on-one, these guys all spoke perfect English,
but
the prosody was just enough different.
But even when you were showing this eye-tracking experiment, you know, there is this experiment where you ask people to attend to different parts of the picture.
Right.
And eye-tracking is very different. If you
right.
ask them how many people are in a picture, what is the wealth of the family,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. So clearly there is this top-down, very strong top-down effect, right? And I don't know, somehow we got lost, I think, during the talk, but there were many things, of course, going on, but that's why I wanted to ask at the end.
Well, I mean, I'm really, let me go back to the beginning. I'm really struck by this idea that it really is this big loop.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm definitely trained as an engineer to start with. And so, you know, I like to, you know, I fit into this binaural world really conference really well because, you know, I want to build things on a solid foundation. I want to know how the cochlea works. I want to know how the inferior cochleus works. I want to, you know, build on solid foundations. And, you know, we're getting to the point where we can't do that because these top-down effects matter. And so, you know, this is the big spaghetti bowl model of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like it. I want to start chipping away at it. And the only way I know how to chip away at it is to figure out what causes your attention to change. And this is way too high up in the C word for me to deal with. So that's way too much C for me.
Yeah, but there's all these relations, right? The saliency, surprises, and all these things. So how does it all interrupt?
Well, agreed. And
so surprises must be coming from top down, right?
No. Well, I mean, you have a model, and so you're saying that, you know, this is the kind of world I'm in.
Yeah.
But, you know, surprise still is a bottom-up signal where it says, you know, this popped out of nowhere, and so you...
Yeah, but you said it out of nowhere, so my model doesn't account for
right.
it, right? I mean, sort of. So if we are in a room full of the German listeners, then knocking on the table is very normal. It's
not very surprising. So I would just say that just means that this loop is stable.
Yes.
That the salient events does depend on some other
yes. Yes. Yes.
top-down stuff, but once that's set, once it's in a state, then it's salient.
And I guess the way we do science is we put things in a particular state and then we probe it. And so, you know, Munoz's experiments or Maria's experiments, there's a particular state involved, and you're asking, you know, how does it change when you do something?
Yeah, you could actually argue essentially the opposite. So the idea that it's top-down, I mean, according to Helmholtz, perception itself is top down. I mean, the way we perceive things is by having internal models and fitting the incoming
right.
sensory information. So this is inherently top down. So you could imagine that in many situations you have an internal model and you're confronting it to the world, and it's confirmed, and this self-confirming loop. It could suggest that what is this idea of salience is when there's something that comes in and breaks you out of that loop. So you're sort of attending, you're listening to everybody speaking and as if we were speaking in English, and then all of a sudden you realize that it's some other language, or
assume
that it's speaking Chinese and actually they're speaking English. It's this sort of thing that pokes in, and it's like you're in a local minimum, and you have this thing that pushes you out of the local minimum
into the next one. I hate to say it, but I mean, Grossberg talks about things like that, and wait a minute. I think it's time to start saying, you know, Grossberg wasn't all wrong, and he's very painful about how he did it, and maybe I shouldn't do this on videotape. But you know, there's a lot of loops going on, and Grossberg had lots of different kinds of loops involved. It wasn't just one loop. But you know, we've got to start breaking this apart in some fashion, and we just can't say it's a spaghetti bowl. Last question.
So on the visual side, so they have these video game playing benchmarks that DeepMind has started, mm-hmm. right? Atari video games. And you know, there's 3D video games, there's lots of stuff going on, right? And so these agents have to pick actions constantly to maximize reward. If you were given a neural network that does this, and clearly there must be some notion of saliency, because events are happening all the time. So if something happens here and you have to turn because it could be a predator or it could be treasure or whatever, right? So how would you systematically test for saliency in these networks that have already trained really well for solving some non-trivial game world?
Well, I think the mapping of saliency to computers is harder because computers don't have the same resource limitations that humans do. So I had slides in this and I took them out because I'm not really an expert on this, but you know, attention is really directed at, you know, the purpose of attention, I believe, is to direct it or to make the resources available where you need them. And so I'm attending to you, I'm listening to you, I'm looking at your reaction. So that's where my resources are going, as opposed to what Jim is doing or somebody else. And computers don't have the same kind of constraints because they can explore all these different paths in parallel.
I disagree there in the sense that there's two ways in which people are using attention now in DeepMind. One is that some of the inputs are so high dimensional that you can't train on them. There's just right. computational over there. So then the saliency map tells you, okay, just focus on this subregion,
right?
Attend to that. And two is that in these games, you really do have to decide
Make a course of action.
Where to look.
Yeah.
Right? Where, like, you get to move a 3D body in a 3D world. Something happens and you have to turn in that direction, right? So you kind of...
But I don't think that's really an attention thing. I think that's just you have to make a decision at some point, and then you start operating that paradigm. I mean, that's true whether you're playing Go, where there's no visual thing.
Yeah.
You know, you make a path and you follow it. But the attention comes in before that, where you have resources to allocate, and computers can. I mean, they do use attention in neural networks now,
yeah.
in a very primitive fashion.
Yeah.
They call it attention, but it's not quite the same mapping between computers and humans there.
So is there a task that you would kind of, like with the eye tracking data or whatever data you guys, is there a task that you guys would put up and then let everyone compete on it?
Oh, hadn't thought about that.
That would solve your problem probably within a year.
We hadn't thought about it. I mean, I think having the data is really important. So, you know, I would dearly love to have a good definition of saliency that we can turn into an experiment. You know, I'm hoping we can do some Amazon search result data and get a lot of data that way, and so I think that's interesting. For not very much money, within an hour we get what Maria took, you know, a week to collect. And so, you know, that's where I'm focusing my efforts.
Malcolm, if you accept the memory definition, it could be, it's not necessarily the best definition, but it could lead to an operational definition to gather data for pretty easily. Suppose that you have a long stream of sound, And the question you ask the subject is detect them as a replication. So that means that they have to, in order to be able to solve, to detect that there is a replication, they have to remember the initial sum.
Yeah.
And so you could use it as a measure of, so you probably have a, you could probably estimate a function of forgetting, mm-hmm. depending on the distance between the two.
Yeah.
And then you look at how,
how it changes.
That would allow you to predict in general how long it's, how likely you are to be able to remember a sound.
Yeah.
And sounds that are more, stick out of that.
Mm-hmm. You have to think about how we could do that on Turk. The paradigm we have now works well because it's one little bit of work and then we get a yes-no answer and well, we can pay him or not. The long stream.
You can do it on Turk if it's Google on Turk. Not
yeah. Well, I've been looking at trying to get lots of data, so that's why Turk is interesting to me. There's lots of problems with Turk, but...
It is a sort of paradigm where you could potentially get lots of data because you could leave a whole bunch of data.
Right.
I mean, it strikes me that there really may be a problem coming up with one single definition of saliency.
Yeah.
It seems very much task dependent.
Perhaps.
It's really a measure of discriminability.
Yeah.
And that how salience may.
It's more than discriminability. It's
but it's related to that because you're asking subjects to detect a change or some repetition, so they have to be able to discriminate the sound elements to be able to make that decision.
Yep.
So I think the answer, I think what you said is valid. And I think in order to make progress, we just have to pick something and try it.
Yeah.
Hopefully the one that's going to work. But I think you're right. I mean, it's finding the basic one is going to be hard. Maybe we'll know that 10 years from now after we try a few things. But, you know, I want to try something. And I want to improve upon these models. And I want to make it work. And, you know, I want to explain the science. I want to explain the brain. I also want to make it work in real life. In devices that we live with. So with that, I'm around for another 2.5 weeks. Oh, tomorrow I'm going to talk about listening effort, which is completely different, but it's a shorter talk, and I'm around for another 2.5 weeks. So thanks for having me here.
Thank you.